Hello, everybody. Today we have the pleasure to interview Dr. Elsa Bernard from the Computational Oncology Service, Department of Epidemiology and Biostatistics of the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center of New York, USA. Thank you for accepting our invitation, Elsa. How are you today?
Thank you very much. I'm good. Thank you. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Today we are going to discuss your recent publication on the New England Journal of Medicine Evidence, which is the new molecular international prognostic scoring system for MDS, for myelodysplastic syndromes. So, first of all, Elsa, can you explain us why it's important to incorporate molecular information into MDS prognostication?
Right. So maybe we can start briefly by explaining why prognostication might be important in MDS,
Correct. Yes.
very briefly. So really, risk stratification, I think, is the tool to help clinicians assess the prognosis of their patients, right? And therefore potentially guide therapeutic strategies. And of course, it is a tool used along other factors such as, patients' preferences. And so in MDS, clinical outcomes are diverse, where lower-risk patients might live many years with quality of life affected by cytopenias and others, while high-risk patients may develop into a life-threatening acute myeloid leukemia. So for those reasons, prognostication is important to try and identify patients that for which the disease might evolve very rapidly versus patients with more indolent clinical course. And in MDL, tools such as the revised IPSS, so International Prognostic Scoring System, have been used for many decades for that purpose. And so the IPSS-R was developed in 2012 by the International Working Group, led by Dr. Peter Greenberg on the clinical side and Heinz Teschler on the statistical side. And while the IPSS-R have been proved very useful in the last decade with the advancement of next-generation sequencing, the molecular landscape of MDS have been described in great details by many groups and seminal studies such as the studies in 2011 by Dr. Rafael Bejar and colleague, or in 2013 by Dr. Haferlack and colleagues. And so those studies, among many others, have shown that gene mutations are independent prognostic markers in MDS alongside established variables such as the one used in the IPSS-R. But in that context, so in that context, there was actually a need to test the independence value of gene mutations in a large and representative MDS cohort, as well as formally developed a new score, a new scoring system that could be used in routine clinical practice.
So, correct. Like after 2012, we basically accrue like a abundance of molecular information, right? As you said, thanks to all these studies. And there was, as of now, up until now, we had like this gap where we knew that like some molecular information could be useful, but for prognostication and for trial enrollment, we relied on clinical and cytogenetic features only, right? In the IPSS-R of Greenberg 2012.
Right.
So, yeah, so I think this was what prompted you to like explore, not the possibility of incorporation of molecular information. Can you tell us how did you accrue the patient cohort and what was the study design?
Correct. Yeah. So patient cohort and study design. So the patient cohort was really built as part of a large collaboration through the International Working Group for the prognostication of MDS and under the auspices of the MDS Foundation. So in total, 24 centers contributed to the study. So they contributed clinical data and patient materials for the development of the IPSS-M. So those centers were from North America, South America, Europe, and Asia. So unfortunately, no centers from Africa, for example. And inclusion criteria required, with regard to study design, inclusion criteria required diagnostic samples or peri-diagnostic samples, treatment naive of from patients with MDS. And the study was designed for adult MDS patients, and we required for the IPSS-M study blast to be less than 20%, and white blood cells to be less than 13,000 cells per microliter, so therefore excluding proliferative CMML. So in practice, those centers sent us at MSKCC DNA material that we sequenced uniformly using a targeted panel-based approach where we sequenced the coding regions of 152 genes that for the most part have been shown to be involved in the pathogenesis of myeloneoplasms. And after QC of the data, in particular sequencing QC, the total cohort size was 2,957 patients with MDS.
Nice. So can you tell us more details about the feature encoding model? How did you build that? And which feature about among these 152 correct genes that you mentioned were then retained?
I see. Okay, so we're getting into the technical details of the model. That's great. So with regard to the variables, including in the IPSS-M, so those variables can be grouped into different categories. So clinical variables, cytogenetic variables, as you said, and gene mutations. And like briefly, in aggregate, those variables were selected based on feature selection techniques that were run to assess the independent prognostic value of the variables across multivariable models across different endpoints. So those endpoints that we evaluated in the analysis stage of feature encoding and feature selection were overall survival, leukemia free survival, and AML transformation. So first, for clinical variables, I think it's important to note that this is a little bit as a difference with the IPSS-R. Clinical variables were encoded continuously, so they lie on a continuous scale, so that if you have a blast, let's say from 9 to 11%, it doesn't lead to a jump in its contribution to risk. So everything is continuous in the IPSS-M. So the clinical variables that were retained by feature selection were hemoglobin, platelet, bone marrow blast. And one difference was that ANC, so absolute neutrophil count, was not independently prognostic in our model. So for simplicity, it was also not included. Then for cytogenetic, we used the established cytogenetic IPSS-R categories, so the five established categories from very good to very poor. We did evaluate if building new cytogenetic categories could be helpful, but we did not see any improvement, so we sticked to the established ones. And then for the gene mutations, so the categories of gene mutations can be separated in two subcategories. So the first one, we call it gene main effects, because those are the variables that are, so 17 variables that are built from 16 genes, where each one of those variables gets a weight that directly contribute to the IPSS-M risk score. And for most of those 16 genes that are very well-known genes in MDS, we encoded them simply as absence of presence of pathogenic or likely pathogenic mutations in those genes. We did evaluate if using the VAR for those genes could improve the model, but that was not significantly the case. So again, we stick to simplicity there. But only for two genes, the encoding was slightly more complex, and those genes were TP53 and SF2B1. So for TP53, we use the allelic state of the gene, so being multi-hit or monoallelic, and this follow some of our recent work where we study the prognostic implication of the allelic state of TP53 in MDS. And in that particular case, we use different levels of evidence to assess TP53 allelic state, such as the number of mutations and the presence of LOH. And then for SF2B1, we also built a slightly more complex feature than presence or absence of mutations based on the patterns of commutations, where we observed that patients with SF2B1 mutations, but absence of co-mutations in genes such as RUNX1 or BCOR do have a more favorable risk. And so that defined one particular features, or for example, that the presence of ASF subunit mutations with isolated 5q, which are both independent, like in univite analysis, favorable risk. When they come together, there is this epistatic interaction so that it's not favorable risk anymore. So for those two genes, the encoding was slightly more complex. And last, so the last category of features, of genetic features, we call it gene residual, and it's actually only one variable which is built from 15 other genes. And this very last variable represents the number of mutated genes within that list of 15 residual genes. And this is because we know, and this has been shown in many studies, that the number of mutations or the number of mutated genes really adds up in risk. So there is this increase when you have more and more adverse mutations. But for the most frequent genes or the more potent ones, we could have, where for those, we could estimate an individual weight. For the residual, maybe the statistical power was too low, so we kind of pulled them together to define this aggregate number of mutations, and to capture in that way some residual risk for those patients.
Okay, thank you. And so the new model, how many category has?
In terms of risk categories, right? Okay.
We had like 5 for the IPSSR, while yours has 6, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. So it has 6 categories, although there are 2 that can be, you know, depending on the resolution, can be pulled together or not. So to explain, so those 6 categories are called very low, low, moderate high, which you can combine in moderate in some cases, high and very high. So 6 categories from very low to very high. And yeah, and those categories are defined based on cutoff that are applied to the risk score. So the IPSSM is both a risk score and risk categories. And the risk score is continuous, so roughly will go from -4 to 4. And based on cutoff in that risk score, we define those 6 risk categories.
Okay, and can I ask you, what are the main characteristics as to molecular landscape and outcomes when we look at these 6 categories?
All right, okay. So first of all, just to understand a little bit those, you know, what it means to be in that category, for example, low versus moderate versus high. So as I said, those categories are defined based on cutoff on the risk score. And we built the IPSSM score such that a delta of -1 or +1 in the scores correspond to half or double risk. So if a patient is on the lower side of the high category, it will have a half risk at the patient of the upper side of the high category, for example, which leads to, so those differences in the risk categories led to well-separated outcomes with regard to leukemia transformation, leukemia for survival, and overall survival. So for example, if we take overall survival as an example, I think the median OS was less than a year for the very high category, and it was about 10 years for the very low category. So, you know, very, very strong differences in outcomes between the different categories, and, you know, granularity in between. And so that is for, you know, disease-specific outcomes within each one of those categories. And the separation was observed for overall survival and transformation to AML. And then with regard to molecular landscape, I think that question is not very easy because given the number of variables that went the IPSSM, so the clinicals, the cytogenetics, and then in total 31 genes, it's really the full profile from all of those variables that contribute to risk, right?
It might be very heterogeneous, but at least like maybe let me rephrase it. Like, did you observe a recapitulation of what you expected as to low risk molecular features in the low risk groups and high risk molecular feature in the high risk group? Or in other words, all multi-hit TP53 cases were more on the upper edge, and instead, like these SF3B1 unique cases with no other mutation were on the lower, you know, this kind of like pattern of distribution of and molecular associations.
Yeah, exactly. Very good point. And also it helps us to understand like how the data works. So as you said, as expected, more than 90%, actually more than 95% of B allelic TP3 cases are in the very high category. Those patients have not only now multi-TP3 is formally part of the model and has a big weight, so it contributes to the score. They also have complex karyotype with its strong contributors, or the risk also have low platelets, and all of the variables are contributing to poor risk. And on the opposite, cases with isolated types of SUBI1 will be, I think it was maybe more than 80% of those were in the very low category. And in between, it's really the contribution of the different genes and clinical variables, of course, that makes the risk and the categories. But maybe what to highlight is, for example, cases that had previously normal karyotype and blasts that were maybe not reaching the very top of close to 20%, but patients that have several mutations, such as U2F1 plus XSL1 plus TV6, those patients have, multiple layers of contribution to the risk. And those are the ones where we understood why now they are maybe in higher risk category than they might have been before.
Right. And we now, like this, like serves me the asset for this following question. So how IPSS-M does relate to its prior version, the IPSS-R? Because of course, as you're saying, we can appreciate probably a restratification of especially this kind of patient you are describing, like the one that were uninformative, let's say, as to the cytogenetic and clinical characteristic that were encoded in the IPSS-R, right?
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, we were discussing this relationship between the IPSR and IPSS-M and restratification as more broadly. So I think, first of all, in terms of the continuity between the two systems, so there is continuity in the sense that we're using the same clinical variables, with the exception of A and C, the same cytogenetic risk categories, with now addition of gene mutation. So with regard, first, I mean, we have to say that we did observe prognostic improvement from the IPSR to the IPSS-M using, established metrics such as C-index. The improvement of C-index was reproduced in an independent cohort that was built from a multi-center Japanese collaborations. And then when we looked at restratification, so patients that had different risk categories assigned as IPSS-R versus the IPSS-M, it was about half of patients were restratified. And this was happening in both directions, sometimes upstage, sometimes downstage. I think the most striking is that for about a bit less than 10% of patients, this restratification was from more than one strata. So for example, previously low risk, now high risk, or vice versa. And maybe the most important point with that in terms of restratification is that I think more than 50% of patients that were previously classified as IPSS-R intermediate were restratified, and about 10% of IPSS-R intermediate patients were either where we certified to the very, very high risk category. And as you just said, this is those patients that were previously low or intermediate and are now very high. Those patients are the ones that had at least two or more adverse mutations, but in average, even more, at least three. So those are the patients for which there was no variables to measure their risk, and now they are captured to some extent.
Thank you. And like this is like such a crucial point, especially for like MDS patient and treatment and clinical management, because of course you can if the patient has an high risk molecular profile, you want to consider that as the clinical management of the patient. Did you notice any relation as to the treatment instead? So how did treatment change the performance of the new score with regards to the outcome explored? Because you say that you use a mainly treatment naive cohort, but you also had some cases so where you could explore the effect of treatment, right?
So it's not mainly. So I think we should clarify it. It's all patients, including all samples, including the study, were treatment naive. Mm-hmm. So all the samples are diagnostic, treatment naive, because this was to reflect the goal of the study, which was to develop a diagnostic tool for the assessment of risk at diagnosis. But then, of course, but the patients were not selected based on the therapy they received during their clinical course. So among those patients after diagnosis, of course, some of them received treatment or so-called disease-modifying treatment. So I think about 30% did receive disease-modifying treatment, mainly hypomethylating agents, and about 10% of patients were received stem cell transplantation. So we wonder exactly what you're saying. Like, are we sure that there's no specific relationship between the variables, including the model, and treatment? So I think I would say for that, it would be a little bit incorrect, statistically at least, to remove the treated patients, because at diagnostic, you don't know which patients are going to be treated. Sure. And if you were to do so, this would lead to kind of over-optimistic outcomes in lower expression and under-optimistic outcomes in higher expression. So they would be somewhat incorrect to do so, but still, I acknowledge this bias. We looked at the IPSSM across different subsets, so the treated versus the not treated patients, just to see if there was no something happening and really working well in one case versus not the other. So I think we were a little bit reassured to see that there was an improvement over the IPSSR in both contexts, in patients that did receive treatment in their clinical course versus not. So that was, reassuring. But this said, the prognostic performances were lower in the treated subset. And this is a little bit difficult to interpret because sample size is also much lower. 30% of the cohort were treated, so we're talking a much smaller cohort there. So in the future, we do need a larger study in that setting. But this might suggest that the treated subset of the cohort represented a more heterogeneous population, was slightly more difficult to model and define the variable that estimates best their risk. So there is some margin of improvement there.
Right, but the main important message I think that I'm getting, and it's important to leave, is that with your model, we can answer the question that the patient on a daily basis ask us, which is, if I'm not treated, what is my life expectancy?
And exactly, because we had because the 70% of patients were untreated in that cohort, and similarly at the IPSSR was previously, and we have a poor full stratification strategies for that subset.
Correct. So it's important to have this tool for also clinical practice. And at least this is my personal opinion. I will strongly support the use of this tool in order to give patients more information about their specific disease with regards to the outcome you explored.
I agree. And I think it's also, I believe it can help also the patients to understand, what are the contributors to the risk. You can almost show the table of the model to someone and tell him, this is the features we measured, and the weights are bigger versus smaller, which explains why. The fact that it's not a black box, in my opinion, can help communication.
Thank you, Elsa. And do you think that the IPSSM will replace the IPSSR for clinical practice and clinical trial involvement in the MDS field? I'm thinking about, for instance, also that NGS is not widely available in all the places in the world. So what is your thought about that?
Right, yeah, very good question. So I think first, before talking about, you know, routinely used, I think we need to see some independent studies evaluating the IPCSM in other cohorts from, you know, different centers, different institutions. So we need to see what's going on there, maybe at this age or subsequent meetings. So that's one point. And then if indeed results are being reproduced, and I think that, you know, molecular markers are increasingly part of MDS diagnostics, not only for prognostication, but also for classification. So we've just seen that in the recent update of the WHO and other ICC guidelines, despite some of differences between the two, they are, you know, increased as used of molecular markers with now multi-hit TP53 or TP53 complex karyotype allelic being a specific subset across myeloid neoplasms, SF-suburban MDS being a recognized entity as well. So if both classification and prognostic markers incorporate gene mutations, system incorporate gene mutation, that would be an incentive for institutions, but as well as regulatory entities to give access to NGS to patients with MDS. So I think those are incentives to have that information for patients with MDS, and that it's going to be increasingly used for trial enrollment and or assessment of new therapeutic strategy to in the interpretation of results to add the IPCSM score and categories, you know, to interpret the results. And maybe even in routine practice, acknowledging that there are some discrepancies in access to NGS. So I think maybe one point I will make it with regard to the practicality of the IPCSM is that we did develop a strategy for missing values, acknowledging that, you know, panel might not include the 31 genes including currently in the model, so that the score can be calculated under missing values with some uncertainty, but in some cases the uncertainty remains limited, and that we will need to see if reproducibility is good and incentive to have access to NGS. I think it will be maybe used.
Thank you very much. So I think we are pretty done for this conversation, and I want to thank you, you and all the IM International Molecular Working Group for MDS. You guys are making history, and thanks for this great contribution to the field, especially because I'm an MDS fan. So we all were waiting for the new prognostication, which incorporated the molecular information that we have seen growing in the recent era. So thank you for your effort from me and from everybody in the MDS world.
Yeah, I also would like I'm echoing you, and I'm also thanking the International Working Group, from whom, you know, I could not have been able to work on this data and trying to contribute to the field. And I'm very grateful for the invitation and the opportunity as well.
Thank you very much. See you next time to everybody listening with a new episode of Training Pearls. Goodbye.